Welcome to The Positivity Effect, where paying it forward and doing something positive in someone's life can provide them with the confidence and motivation to do the same for someone else. Like a stone dropped into a lake, let's create a ripple effect of positivity throughout our world. And it begins with your host, Dr. Thomas Retscher.
Hey, Dr. Tom here. Welcome back and Happy New Year, guys. You're listening to The Positivity Effect, and this is episode number 10. This is also the first interview of 2016, and it's a deep one, so I hope you guys are ready to think. But before we dive into the call, if you're loving the show, please check out positivityeffect.com, where you can catch all the episodes and the show notes, as well as subscribe to the newsletter. And guys, please write to me. Share a story of something that you're grateful for in your life, because I'm going to pick one listener's inspiring story every week to share on the Sunday Fireside Chat. So write to me, let me know what you think about the show, and I'd love to hear from you as well and just get to know you. In addition to finding the show on the website, if you'd like, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Just search Positivity Effect, hit the subscribe button, and you'll never miss a positive message. So I'm super excited about this week's show. We have on Dr. Jim Davies, the author of the book Riveted, The Science of Why Jokes Make Us Laugh, Movies Make Us Cry, and Religion Makes Us Feel One with the Universe. Dr. Davies is a cognitive scientist and a frequent contributor to the popular science magazine Nautilus. Dr. Davies is an award-winning associate professor at Carleton University's Institute of Cognitive Science, and he's the director of the Science of Imagination Laboratory. In 2010, he gave a TEDx talk about mistakes people make when imagining their future. And, you know, Dr. Davies, he's just a super intelligent guy, and I can't wait for you all to hear and listen to this interview. I want you guys really to pay close attention to his points about mutual dependence and effective altruism. It's really interesting stuff. So it's time. Let's jump into another episode of The Positivity Effect. Dr. Davies, welcome to The Positivity Effect.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. It really means a lot.
Sure.
So let's jump right into it. Dr. Davies, what inspired you to write your book, Riveted?
So Riveted's a book about the underlying foundations of why we find things interesting, and trying to draw similarities between things like sports and arts and religion. And it was inspired by my history in the arts. So I'm a painter and, you know, improviser and comedian and dancer. I do lots of arts in my spare time. And there's all this folk wisdom in the arts about, you know, how to do it right, how to do it well, how to make things work. And it's not really backed up by science, a lot of it. And I, as I got trained as a scientist in graduate school, I was thinking, you know, well, I wonder if you could apply the scientific method to some of these rules in art and see if there's any evidence for them. And I was pretty busy in grad school, but after I got out of grad school, I was able to look into it and found that there was this really a great proliferation of research into the psychology of art. Mm-hmm. And I had this idea in the back of my mind for probably 10 years to write a book about it. But then I also started looking at the psychology of religion just out of my own interest, and it struck me that a lot of the reasons that people are attracted to religion are the same reasons that they're attracted to art. So the book is sort of a case for the underlying things that just make us find things compelling in all of these different areas.
And what are, you know, you talk about how the arts, like if you were to just take a piece of paper, put it on the, you know, and make a chart where you have left and right, you got the arts on the left and you have religion on the right, and you're kind of comparing. What are some of these themes that kind of came up as you started to really dive deep into this and analyze the two?
Okay, so one of the main themes is that we're really interested in social information. So we spent the majority of our evolutionary history in you know, groups of about 150 individuals on the African savanna with very low technology. And the survival back then really depended on how well you got along with and were able to, you know, get and share resources from the other people in your community. And that's still true today. You can't really survive today and flourish, and you certainly can't reproduce today without somebody else. Right. So we evolved to really pay attention to these constantly shifting, networks of social relationships. So we've got this built-in desire to understand other people. And when you look at the arts, it's all about people. So I even did a survey of paintings and found out that the majority of paintings are about, they feature people in them. Stories always involve people and the conflicts between them. Gossip is about people. And then interestingly, when you look at religion, it's all about people too. So the gods, and when I say gods, I mean that very broadly, meaning ghosts and spirits and, everything else. They've mostly got very recognizable human psychologies. They have desires and beliefs and these kinds of things. And, we just got moral opinions. And that's just one example. And the book, chapter by chapter goes through, other things that are similar across all these different fields.
It's interesting that you said that word mutual dependence. That's where, as a whole, as a species, we really start to thrive. And it's been true evolutionarily. That's how mm-hmm. groups would always stand out and when they work together. And on this show, we really talk about a lot of things like personal growth and ways to be more positive in our lives. And I think sometimes we try to take on these tasks, these monumental tasks of improving ourselves in some way by ourselves. Right. And then once you see someone, when you hear a story of someone that made a big growth or a change in their life, it was because they had a backing of people around them, or they had, they were able to step outside themselves and say, okay, I need help. Let me go to, like you said, somebody in my community or somebody that knows how to do this better than I do. So why really, with that said, why is mutual dependence so important for thriving?
Well, it's the nature of our species. There are certain species that are very solitary, and they, octopus, for example, they don't hunt in packs. They're ambush predators. And, if we upgraded our, but if we upgraded like an octopus intelligence, or if octopuses had become the dominant intelligent species on Earth, it might be a very different situation, because they just had a different ecological niche that didn't evolve teamwork. So, because we have evolved that way, we have this, vast interest in social interdependence. And I think a good way to think about it, just in terms of like a positivity mantra or something, is, that we thrive in groups, not as individuals. And as much as you might want to be interested in bettering yourself, a great way to do that is to help other people, and you build, networks of friendship and trust and goodwill and all these kinds of things. One way to think about it is, oh, I'm going to be exploited if I help everybody. But it's also nice to think like, oh, it's not a bad position to have everybody owing you a favor. You know what I mean? Because that's how you get jobs. That's how you get friends and work and all these other things. There's a neat book. I don't know if you've looked at it, but The Village Effect by Susan Pinker came out fairly recently. And it makes the case that your network of social relationships is more important to longevity and happiness than exercise, diet, stopping smoking. Like, it's the most important thing for health and happiness are your social relationships. So it seems to be very built into the tapestry of our species.
And would you say, someone that maybe feels that they're nowhere where they want to be, that's the first thing that they should maybe, it's something that they should analyze, because maybe they're surrounding themselves with people that aren't influencing them at the point in the right way that they should be influencing them.
Yeah, I think I don't know if it's the first thing, but it's certainly an important thing. There's a saying, and I think it's a little overblown, but there's some truth to it, that you are the average of your five best friends or something like that.
Jim Rohn, yeah.
Yeah, and you should certainly, strive to be surrounded with people who share your ambitions and goals and values and life outlooks in ways that'll help you, become the person that you want to be.
Yeah. Thinking about this idea of these core qualities that maybe somebody's trying to nurture, to live a fulfilling life. And when I say fulfilling in the terms of one that reflects something good and morally, like we mentioned altruism, I often talk about gratitude and empathy on the show.
Right.
I frame it this way because I think there's always going to be people too that find violence compelling and riveting, So what are some of these things that these kind of core qualities that someone should focus on to kind of live a life more of altruism? And you mentioned that term before we got an effective altruism.
Yeah. Well, violence is an interesting example. Many people are attracted to violence in, what I think is going on is that it's the same reason that we, you know, rubberneck a car accident when we drive by, is that our minds are wired to try to pay attention to dangerous situations because we're trying to learn about that situation. So if you watch a violent movie, for example, and I love, you know, kung fu movies, and, you know, I like it just as much as the next person. And, you know, most of our mind doesn't realize when we're watching a movie that it's actually a movie. That's why you have to tell yourself it's only a movie when you watch a horror movie or something like this, because a lot of your mind doesn't really realize that, and it's getting frightened, and you end up dreaming about it and this kind of thing.
So it's like, you know, like crying during like Finding Nemo.
Crying during Finding Nemo. Like you know, why are you crying at a bunch of like computer generated pixels that generate light on a screen? Like, it's kind of ridiculous when you think of it that way, but most of your mind can't help but interpret the situation as real in some sense. And when you think about our evolutionary environment, we didn't have any media. There were no real representations of people other than speech. If you saw what appeared to be a person, it was a person. If you saw a battle with knives, it was probably people you knew, and you damn well better know who's fighting and why and who wins. So you can imagine that the people who paid attention to shifting alliances and fights like that and shifting social status were able to outcompete the people who didn't pay any attention. So, you know, I don't think it's bad for you to pay attention to violence necessarily. You know, I certainly wouldn't promote violence.
Right, right.
It is important social information. Or so we're evolved to think.
It allows us to know what to avoid.
Yeah, well, it might teach us something about how to avoid violence. You know, if you watch a movie, you know, where people, you know, what we might call cautionary tales, where, you know, people come to a bad end because of the, you know, bad decisions they've made, then you can certainly learn from that.
Why would you think someone gets stuck in like a feedback loop that's negative? Like, you know, it's someone in you, maybe someone in your life, and it's like the sky is always falling. No matter how you pitch it to them, something is always wrong with that situation.
Most of it's genetic. I hate to say it, but I think about 50 to 60% of that is just the way they are. I mean, some people just, you know, see the glass half empty. And, you know, there might be things they can do to try to change that, but I don't think that there's, you know, I mean, certainly if there was something that happened, like a parent died or whatever. I remember my mother saying that after her father died, I think my mother was 13 or something. It was like a year later that she started noticing color in the world again. And it,
wow.
You know, so certainly her, you know, negative attitude toward life had a traceable cause. Yeah. But, you know, for somebody who's just, people have a set level of happiness that's just sort of ingrained in them. That's very hard to budge. And I think for most people, it's just something they have to learn to deal with. And, it wasn't something that they brought on themselves.
Yeah. You know, I often talk about this on the show, like this idea that when somebody walks in the room, whether they have a positive outlook about them or a negative one, just by the way that they're carrying themselves, is they don't even have to open their mouth, you know, all these intangibles, just by looking at them, sensing them, there's like this energy on them, you know. What are some of these qualities that like somebody possesses that makes them riveting, you know, when they walk in a room, whether albeit good or bad?
That's something that I get asked a lot, and actually the book doesn't touch on, is people, you know, the book's about what makes riveting art, what makes a riveting belief, or these kind of things. And I'm often asked, what makes a riveting person? How can a person be more compelling? And I actually haven't done a lot of research in that. But certainly people are more attracted to extroverts, and a lot of the warmth is actually very, people tend to like that. And I think that you can be compelling in different ways. So certain people excel, they have like a niche, right? Like they're compelling because they seem like the kind of person you could trust. Like you sometimes you meet people and you're like, this seems like just a person with a heart of gold that I would trust with my, you know, I'd give them the keys to my house right now. And then other people walk in the room, you might not feel that goodness and trust, but you might get a really strong sense of, this person knows what they're talking about. This person is a leader. This person is, you know, just a powerful presence, you know. And I think that there are subtle cues that people deliver to help nurture those things. I haven't done a lot of research on it. I did hear an interesting story about Bill Clinton, who's apparently one of the most riveting people to meet. Like
effective leaders, yeah.
Yeah, like just to meet him. Apparently he's like one of the like people who meet him are just like, "Oh my god, he's just so you know, after you meet him, you're just like in love with him, right?" So I heard a story about how he was talking to somebody and he was like looking them right in the eye and someone came over and tried to interrupt. And, you know, the person he was talking to was a nobody as far as anybody's concerned. And he turned to the interrupter and said, "Excuse me, I'm talking to this person right now." And then turned back and gave him absolute full attention. And this is, you know, somebody who is or was the president of the United States, you know. And when you give people that kind of respect and you're not always looking over your shoulder to say, "Oh, who's more interesting I could talk to?" You know, people, you know, they really appreciate that.
That's so true. I mean, you think about it, like, especially in the business world, like when we go to these networking events and it's like, you're having a conversation with someone and you're thinking, who is the next person I could be speaking to? When we should be dialing in on that conversation that we're having.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Giving people your full attention when you're talking to them is one great way to really be liked.
You know, it's so true too, you know, talking about, if we're trying to, you know, we're having struggles in our own life, but even when we're dealing with things in our own life, and you mentioned it when we first started the call about just going and helping somebody, you know, that immediately takes the focus away from yourself about what you're struggling with. And once you go and help that person, it's that altruism, you know? And I think when we do go and finally do an act where we're helping somebody, when we put our full attention to it and our full heart into it, that it, you know, the 10x rule of what comes back to you, you know, and how you're going to feel better about yourself. And I think it's okay to be selfish in that way. Like we talk about selfishness, like we shouldn't, you know, I think when we're going to help somebody, we should absolutely be selfish.
Yeah. I mean, selfish usually means that you're doing something to hurt. I mean, you're helping yourself by hurting someone else. But I think what you mean is that if you also feel good about helping somebody, then that's totally fine. And I agree with that. You know, I think that there should be social rewards for, you know, good acts. And I really like the fact that there are literal awards for people who do great things in this world and try to better humanity and that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, like I know it's definitely important too. Like if we go out, you know, always that saying like do an act, but don't tell anybody about it. But you could still tell yourself about it. You know, you could still like go home at the end of the night and be like, "Yeah, I did a good deed today." You know, I think people are afraid to accept that sometimes.
Yeah, there's this idea that it's sort of not legitimate if you've got some, if it's benefiting you, you know, but, I think that's pretty silly. I mean, if we restrict helping people to only times when we are not going to be helped in any way, including feeling good about it, we're just going to have a lot less good doing happening.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Davies, can you talk more about this idea of effective altruism?
So effective altruism is a movement that tries to apply critical thinking and science and data to charity. So if you want to make the world better, a really good question to ask is, well, how can I have the most impact that I possibly can? And so when most people like think about doing some good for the world, they actually don't think about it that way. They're very opportunistic in terms of like, oh, if somebody knocks on my door or there's a food drive at my work, then I will maybe donate my time or money to that. As opposed to, okay, look, I've got, you know, let's say, how much money do I want to give every year? Do I want to give like 1% of my income? Do I want to give $100? And if I'm going to do that, you know, what do I really care about and what is the best use of my money, right? So effective altruists, you know, they kind of treat charities like return on investment. So, you know, how many lives can I save? You know, or, you know, so there are some charity. Now, of course, most charities are better than spending money on, you know, video games or whatever, or vacation. But
right.
But if we're just talking about charity versus charity, there are some charities that might make you feel really good to donate to, but actually do very little good in the world. I think a really good example is like the Make-A-Wish Foundation, where I think some kid like was dying of cancer and he wanted to get visited by Batman in the Batmobile. And they raised all this money to hire an actor and get the Batmobile. And, you know, you could have saved like 4 lives in the developing world for the cost of like having this kid meet Batman. You know, so
right.
So those are the questions that get asked, right? And they come up with really interesting conclusions when you start thinking about it this way. It's like, okay, well, what work should you do if you really want to help the world? And some people say, well, you know, maybe you should be a teacher or a social worker or a doctor or something like that. And you know, and the effective altruists say, well, you know what? Why don't you get a job on Wall Street and make $150,000 a year and donate $70,000 a year to the poor. And you'd actually be,
effective.
You can calculate, the best charities now, I think if you, $2,000 will save a life. So, if you think about how many lives you could save over the course of your lifetime just from donating money, you turn yourself, the extreme of it is you turn yourself into a wealth redistribution tool. and you could count the number of lives you could save over the course of your life. So it's just if anyone wants to read about it, there are a couple books on effective altruism. There's The Most Good You Can Do by Peter Singer came out like 6 months ago, and it's a very, very interesting read. Even if it doesn't change your life, it's very thought provoking.
So it's almost like it's approaching it in a more of a proactive way rather than reactive. Like,
that's for sure. And, I know you talk about empathy, and one interesting finding is that people who have higher empathy, people who, really feel for other people, actually can make less effective altruists because they are more susceptible to some of the biases that we have with regard to feel-good charities, right? So, studies show people are more willing to donate money to save one person than to save two or 100.
Or, but, like, even what are they donating to?
Did
they full research on it?
So if you actually are the kind of person who feels deep empathy for individuals, which is what empathy usually is, you're more likely to be less effective of an altruist because you give to the one that has a cute picture of a panda or a little kid who's starving that promises to save this one child rather than a more effective, like, all right, we're buying malaria nets, we're buying mosquito nets, we need as many as we can, and it feels kind of diffuse. And it doesn't tug on your heartstrings as much. So the people who have more of a cold, calculating attitude toward charity can actually be more effective than people who have empathy.
That's very interesting. I'm sure, I think we all like have ways of that. Like, I know myself, like I love pets. I have a dog, I have a few cats, and like I'll go to Petco to like check out and get a few things, and like right on the line, wasn't even thinking about it 5 minutes prior, they're like, oh, do you want to donate an extra dollar to save a dog or something, and I'm like, sure, because I'm thinking about the pets, and like, was I really being proactive in that approach? Was I being effectively altruistic? I don't know. And
you're not being super deliberate about it. You're being opportunistic, so there's very interesting questions like, okay, well, why are you donating to save dogs? Like, well, do you care about the welfare of animals? If you care about the welfare of animals, the vast majority of the horrors of animals is in the meat industry. Like,
yes.
So I think it's amazing that people will like go on and on about how horrendous, people who have puppy mills are while they're eating a chicken dinner. Like, it's really, it's amazing hypocrisy. Like chickens are, if anyone did to a dog what people do to chickens routinely, they would be arrested.
Yeah.
And you're basically paying for that by eating chicken that you buy at the grocery store, but that's just one of the ways that that your biases mess with you,
It's so true. And like, maybe just in that moment, was I doing it for the shot of dopamine in my brain to feel good? It's like, who knows? Like, I like to say that I did it for the right reasons, but it's interesting that this idea that you bring up about effective altruism, where it's like, it's more of a thought out, like, this is how I'm going to be most effective in the world. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a very fascinating field. And there are now charity rankers online, like GiveWell is a website that basically ranks charities according to how effective they are. So, anybody who listens to this, if it's like for their birthday, they could, on their list, they could say, if you want to donate something in my name, go to GiveWell, and any of the top 10 charities would be great. And, if you don't need any more junk, you can have people give in your name.
Give in your name. Yeah. I love it. So changing gears a little bit, I want to talk about the book some more. Chapter 2, the title, Wizard's First Rule, Hope and Fear's Anti-Sweet Spot. By the way, excellent book, Wizard's First Rule. You say, the two conflicting drives coming from fear and hope stem from different psychological needs. Our need to experience fear comes from our need to learn to avoid danger. Hope can help us start difficult or frightening tasks, but the desire to experience hope can also come from bypassing the normal routes to the gratification of being right and feeling good about oneself. So can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah. So what this means is that you have such a desire to feel hopeful about the future that you can let yourself get sucked into scams. That's one way to put it. So people who are, you know, dying of a disease, and they might feel, or someone they love is dying of a disease, they might fall prey to, you know, cunning people who promise them easy ways out, right? Like,
right.
Oh, all you gotta do is meditate and you can cure yourself of cancer, or, you know, I think even Steve Jobs, like, used alternative medicine and it hastened his death, you know, because he didn't follow, you know, scientific medical advice. So, you've got or get rich quick schemes. If you're poor and you've got nothing to lose, you can become very prone to risk and, you know, talk yourself into believing something because it just feels so good to have the hope that things are going to get better, you know. So you got to be really careful about that because people, you know, they want to feel hopeful and they are more likely to, you know, jump onto belief systems that will give them that hope, even if that belief system is totally bunk. And the worst thing about it is that there are people out there who will make profit on you, who take advantage of the scared, and take advantage of people who really are desperate for hope to try to get their money.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about this idea of productivity. Do you think, like, if we are prone to, you know, if we have more hope, or we're prone to, like, for instance, someone with a get rich quick scheme, like maybe there's someone that's more reactive to situations. But if they really had more of a plan for what they wanted to do in life, they can weigh the risks and the, you know, the rewards a little bit better, and, you know.
Yeah, maybe. It's something interesting. There's something interesting from artificial intelligence that I've applied to, like, thinking about this. You know, there's a lot of talk about goals and planning in you know, self-improvement, right? But the opposite of, or the other end of the spectrum for is up being opportunistic in terms of taking opportunities, you know, and you can actually miss out on opportunities because you're too goal focused. And, you know, and just to give it's kind of a silly example, but it is one that really happened to me. I was in graduate school and I didn't have a lot of money. And I was like, all right, I'm not going to spend any discretionary money until I have saved up like this amount or something like that. And then the Beastie Boys came out with this web promotion where you could, like, custom make a CD of all these remixes and whatever that were unavailable. I mean, frankly, unavailable. And you could just, like, make your own CD and then pay for it, and then they would send it to you. I mean, nowadays it's all available, of course, but this is, you know, 2002 or something like that. Mm. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to be good. I'm going to follow my goal. I'm going to wait. And then by the time I had the money, the offer was gone and I couldn't possibly do it. And, you know, it's like, oh, you know, like, did I really have to be that strict about this goal that, you know, now I've missed out on, like, all this music that I really, really wanted and couldn't blow $12 or whatever it was, right, you know, for something like that. And the same goes for, like, opportunities. Like, if you're starting a business or you're trying to do this or that, if an opportunity comes along that's better, you need to be ready to drop what you've already invested time and money into for something better. You need to be ready to do that, you know, and you know, you shouldn't be caught up in the momentum of throwing, you know, possibly bad money or good money after bad, or, you know, less good money when it could be put towards something else. Yeah. So I think a lot of people suffer from not having goals and next actions and all those kind of things. But, you know, I think it should be tempered with opportunism.
We shouldn't be too extreme about it. Like, open, like, if we're going to set our goals, you know, also, I mean, you're going to do this, but always be open for those opportunities that could come up.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people are a little too much on the opportunistic side. But, you know, I think it depends on your personality. You need to be reflective about it. But, you know, if you're like, oh, I'm going to work on my book for this week, and then someone offers you a paid trip to New York, you know, you take the trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, writing a book is no small task. And I think the principles into how you have to write the book and you know, set aside time and all the prep work, everything. I think that applies to anything in life, whether somebody's trying to be more positive or they're trying to find some new friends or, you know, have a better fitness plan. So, you know, we talked about this before we jumped on, like, what are some ways that you really hacked your life to be a more productive writer where you were able to stay focused, stay on task, and get your book done ultimately?
Well, so I'm going to tell you how I plan my day, and it's going to sound crazy. But I want your listeners to try it for a week before they decide it's not for them. Because a lot of people hear it and they're like, that would never work for me. And I just don't believe you. I just love it. Don't believe you. Like, you have to try it, and you have to try it for a week because the first day is going to be crazy. But here's how it works. You get out a piece of paper every morning, or I use a spreadsheet on Google Docs or whatever, and then you write down every half hour of the day, of the waking day. So let's say you get up at 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock, 9:30. Every half hour until you go to bed, you write down on the left hand side of a piece of paper. Then you go to your prioritized to-do list, your project list, or whatever you want to call it. And the first thing you do is you go to your calendar and you put in all of your scheduled things, meetings, lunch, commute time, whatever you got, put that in there. And then what you're going to do is you can look and see how many half hours you have left. Okay. Then what you do is you go to your to-do list and you start filling in the most important things earlier in the day. And you fill in the other half hours so that you've got your entire day scheduled in terms of half hours. Now, here's the thing. First of all, you put the most important things first because often your day will get out of hand and you'll have to throw away these half hours later in the day, but at least you'll have gotten the most important things done. And I say most important, not necessarily the most urgent. So like writing a book, I try to write in my book for half an hour or an hour every morning. I don't always get to it, but that's when I try to do it because the day gets crazy later on. The other thing that people find unintuitive is that you don't do anything for longer than half an hour.
Because it's just our attention. We're much more focused in that 30-minute span, I guess.
Well, you are, partially because once you do this, you're like, holy crap, I only have half an hour to work on this today? Like, most of us have too much to do. And then you're like, oh my God, I only have half an hour. And I'll tell you, when you start, if you futz around an email for 5 minutes, you look at the clock, you're like, oh my God, I only have 25 minutes today to work on this because everything else is booked. And the fear of God gets in you and you actually work really hard. So you're only so basically, if you're a busy person, you've got, 10 different things you're working on every single day. You might say, well, I can't get any work done during that. Well, that's wrong. That is wrong. And they've proved it scientifically. So a guy named Boyce, he did a study for writing, actually. And he said, he gave one group, you guys write the way you always do. Now, the way most people write is they do binge writing. It's like, oh, I can't write unless I have like a good 5 hours to really get into it. Okay. He's like, all right, fine. You guys write the way you always write. Another group, he said, all right, I want you guys to write 20 to 40 minutes a day. Like, okay. And the third group, they said, all right, tell me a charity you don't like. Okay, let's say it's the NRA or whatever, some charity you don't like. Then you make them write a check to that charity for $100. And then you say, all right, we're going to check on you every day. If you don't do your writing every day, we are going to send this check in. This is very motivating.
Oh, yeah.
They'd be donating to a cause they really don't believe in, right? The difference between the binge writers and the ones who were forced to write 20 to 40 minutes a day was a 70% increase, 70, in productivity.
Wow.
And this is just writing 20 minutes a day. Now, this is possible. Now, when you just sit down to write, you're like, you spend the first 20 minutes or the first half an hour just figuring out where the hell you are and where to begin. People think it's going to be like that every day. It's not. The first day is going to be like that. The second day might be like that. But the thing is, if you work on something every day, you pick up where you left off. It's still fresh in your mind. Now, the other benefit is, if you're working on everything every day, you start to see connections between things. And you're working on everything every day, everything's fresh in your mind. When you talk to somebody or you read something, you're like, oh yeah, that's relevant to this project I was working on, right?
And it starts to just kind of compound.
Yeah. And then the final thing, I think, unless I think of something else, the final thing that's great about it is that often when you start a project, you don't realize what you need from somebody else. So you might like have something due in 6 months. You're like, well, I'm going to, that'll only take me a week, so I'm going to start a week before. Well, what if a week before you realize that you actually need something from somebody else? And then you're going to be waiting on them. So if you start it now, you will quickly see, oh, you know what? I actually need this person to do this piece, and you can start getting them on it. This is what I do every day. I actually plan out all my half hours, and I decide what I'm going to be doing every half hour of the waking day. And I plan in breaks. I plan in naps. I plan in food. But it really gets you in gear.
What was, like a time in your life where you weren't so focused on the planning and it actually kind of affected, how you worked and how you were productive?
Well, the big problem when you don't do this is a lot of people, especially if they have lots of things to do, like if you got a kind of job where you just do one thing all day, it's not an issue. But if you're the kind of, if you have the kind of job, and a lot of white collar jobs are like this, where there are a million things to do, you spend a lot of time and stress and mental energy trying to figure out what you should be doing and trying to keep in mind the memory of other things you need to do. So while you're actually working on writing a report, you're thinking, oh my God, I have to do this too. I can't forget. And that makes you less productive in the moment. So if you trust your to-do list, if you trust your project list, and you and you're confident that everything you have to do is in there and it's prioritized, and every morning you just like put things in your half hours according to priority, then you can sort of relax your mind and say, all right, I'm going to, for today, I'm going to trust my schedule, that I'm going to, that every half hour that I'm working, if I follow my schedule, I am working on the most important thing I should be working on for that half hour. And you can really focus because you trust that you're not missing anything.
Yeah.
And once you start doing that, you start to realize how much stress it is and how much mental energy and resources and working memory load it takes to keep stuff that you have to do in your head rather than in some separate medium.
Was there a time, like at the point when you were writing the book, where like you had one of those moments where it was like, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, there's just way too many tasks to do today. You know, I'm not focused.
It happens all the time because even though I tell you I do this every day, there's some days I don't. And often if I'm feeling like overwhelmed, my desk is full and my email box is full and I'm like starting to get depressed and I don't know where to turn and I'm paralyzed, I just say to myself, make your half hours. That's what you didn't do today. That's where you screwed up. And I tell you, as soon as I do it, it's like the fog lifts.
Oh man. You know?
So I still struggle with it because I don't, you know, I'm busy today, I'm too busy to make my half hours. And then I have an hour between meetings and I'm like, what the hell do I do with my life? What the hell am I supposed to do with this hour? I don't even know. Like I got a pile of stuff over here. I got an email box full. I've got, you know, deadlines. What am I supposed to do?
Right. And like, but once you focus in and you say, yeah, let me put my half hours in, it's just the day flows. It's so much calmer because you know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. Yep. So I wrote a book that's not published on how to be a scientist. And, you know, that book was different from many books because it didn't require a lot of research. It was mostly just my experience and things that I just already knew. But I wrote that book on 20 minutes to half an hour a day for 9 months. I wrote an entire 200-page book.
Wow. And I was using that productivity system.
Yep. Yep. I did. Yeah. And then Riveted took me about 3 years and working about an hour a day. Now, I let myself work on my books for an hour at a time instead of a half an hour because I enjoy it so much that I don't find myself getting distracted. So some of your listeners might be thinking, well, a half an hour is not enough time for me. I'm going to set it for an hour. But if you're like, okay, try half an hour first because a lot of people, and I'm one of them, if I give myself an hour to do something, it feels like a lot of time and I let myself get a snack, check my email, look at Facebook. For me, half hour is a sweet spot, and I recommend that people try that before they try to extend it.
And I hate to say the whole like you know, do something and get a reward type of thing out of it, but it can be a reward. Like you do your half hour, and then you can go get that snack or the lunch that you're waiting for. You know, instead of like just like you said, like kind of floating within that hour and not being fully
effective. There are philosophies that actually try to schedule in little rewards. Like I don't do that. I mean, I give myself breaks. Or sometimes if I get something done within the first 10 minutes of the half hour, I will say, oh, I got 20 minutes free and I'll let myself like play a video game or something. But there are philosophies where you work 25 minutes and then spend 5 minutes doing whatever you want. So you get like a 5 minute break every half hour, but I generally don't do that. Every 25 minutes rather, and, you know, and I don't do that. I just schedule in like nap times and break times and whatever.
Right.
But yeah, you could reward yourself if you needed to. But to me, I get so much done in the half hour that it's intrinsically rewarding.
That you really have that intrinsic reward. Yeah. Well, Dr. Davies, you know, time is our most precious commodity and I know I'm up. It's been so wonderful. You know, you've been so great. I just want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
If you were suddenly at the end of your life and you were reflecting on all that you've been through, all that you've created, what kind of impact would you want to be remembered for?
I want to be remembered for the Riveted book. I want that to spawn an entire like interdisciplinary field of what, you know, people find compelling. And I hope that it's, you know, a book that people that inspires scientific research.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And, you know, you inspired me today. And seriously, the book Riveted, it's so jam packed with great content. Thank you for sharing your personal stories. Give our listeners one last word of wisdom, and then we'll say goodbye.
Oh, one last word of wisdom. Let's see. I will say the secret to feeling good is being good.
Love it. Dr. Davies, our audience is well aware they can find links to everything of value that we mentioned in today's episode by going to positivityeffect.com, clicking the podcast tab, and finding you right in the archives, or just entering your name in the search bar, and your show notes page will pop right up. So thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time and your energy. I could definitely say that we've been empowered by your positivity. So Dr. Davies, be well, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Positivity Effect. I promise to keep sharing inspiring stories with the guests each and every Monday. I hope you feel inspired, and I hope that we stirred some self-reflection in you on topics like transparency and compassion and empathy. Please check out the website at positivityeffect.com. Sign up for the newsletter, and I'll send you some tips to get you thinking more positively. I would also love to hear from all of you, so please write to me, because every Sunday I'm going to share an inspiring story from one of the listeners, just like yourself. If you have a story where you exhibited compassion towards someone or you paid it forward, I'd love to hear about it. So thanks again. If you love the show, please head over to iTunes, leave a review. It means the world. Take care, and talk to you next Monday.